Chapter 13. Gavin drafted a blue platform, thin, barely visible against the water it floated on.
"You did that just to make me nervous, didn't you?"
Caris asked. Gavin grinned and stepped onto the scull. He extended a hand to Caris, giving her a little bow. She ignored his hand and hopped aboard. He pulled up the keel as she landed, so the scull zipped out from under her feet. She yelped, and he caught her with a cushion of softer green Luxon that quickly morphed into a seat. He lifted the seat and placed it on the front of the skull, then bound both of their packs to the skull near his feet.
"Gavin, I'm not going to sit while you—"
She tried to stand, and he threw the skull forward. With nothing to hold on to, she tumbled back into the chair with another yelp. Gavin laughed. Caris was one of the best warriors the Chromeria had, and she still squeaked when surprised. She shot a look back at him, peeved and amused at once. "I thought you'd like being swept off your feet," he said.
"You had your chance for that," she shot back.
His grin dropped into the waves like so many other treasures and disappeared. Caris looked dismayed.
"Gavin, I—"
"No, I deserved that. Please, go ahead and stand." 16 years. You'd think we'd both have moved on. Not that we haven't both tried.
"Thank you,"
she said, but her voice was contrite. She stood up, feet wide, knees slightly bent. The skull was propelled by banks of little oars jutting out from each side. Through generations of study, green and blue drafters had figured out how to use gears and wheels and chains to drive the oars, each drafter customizing his craft to fit his own body so that he could propel it with whatever combination of arm and leg movements he preferred, and making whatever tweaks he thought made it more efficient. Because the craft had so little friction with the water, an athletic drafter could go the speed of a sprinting man for an hour. That was fast, very fast, but it wasn't nearly as fast as Gavin had promised. Still, he leaned fully forward, his body suspended in a web of Luxon, arms and legs pumping. He elongated and narrowed the skull so it became a dagger knifing over the water's face. They attained full speed as they left the harbour. Gavin was sweating, but it was a good, clean feeling. The wind blew in his face, carrying away any words either he or Caris might have said, and without words, there was simply her presence. The sight of her dark hair whipping in the sea wind, the strong lines of her face, skin glowing in the morning light, chin lifted, neck extended, enjoying the freedom as much as he was. Caris was facing forward, so she didn't see him draft the Luxon scoops into the water. Gavin had always thought there had to be a better way. After all, a drafter could throw a fireball at any speed. It was only dependent on will. If he threw something too big or too fast, of course he might hurt himself from absorbing the kick. But skulls didn't take advantage of will. They were instead perfect rowing watercraft that used muscle power more efficiently than any other machine. Gavin wanted to do better. He wanted to use magic the way a sail used wind. That had only led to ripping off a mast or two, but he refused to give up. It had been one of his 7 goals when he'd still had 7 years left to live. Learn to travel faster than anyone thinks is possible. The solution had come to him from when he was a child, shooting seeds through a reed at his brother's. Air, trapped between a plug and the walls of the reed, could shoot a seed with much greater force than if you'd simply tried to throw it with your hand. After a lot of trial and error, he'd put the whole reed in the water, opening it at both ends so it travelled fully underwater. He attached another reed diagonally and shot plugs of magic down into the water and then out the back of the reeds. He let the oars drop and the whole mechanism fell away with barely a splash, Luxon dissolving even as it hit the waves. He put his hands to the reeds. At the first thump, Caris jerked. She squatted deeper to lower her centre of gravity, and her hand went instinctively to her ataghan, except that it was in her pack. Then the skull leapt forward. The first great thumps shook everything as Gavin strained to get up to speed, his muscles knotting with effort. But within moments, the skull levelled off, and the tension on Gavin's arms and shoulders eased somewhat. The plugs hit the water at a steady whoop, whoop, whoop. The modified skull, what he called his skimmer, barely kissed the waves. There was still physical effort. Gavin was throwing a lot of force into the water, and his arms and shoulders were basically lifting all of his own weight plus Karis's. But magic could be drafted from the whole body, so it was like carrying a heavy pack with the straps distributing the weight perfectly, strenuous but not crushing. Still, in the last year of doing this every day, his shoulders and arms had gotten bigger than in his entire life. Karis turned. Her mouth literally hung open. She stared at the entire contraption, the scoops of blue Luxin given flexibility throughout with green, with the super-flexible, sticky red where the plugs shot into the reeds so they wouldn't be shattered. She straightened, slowly leaning into the wind, her back against Gavin, so that she wasn't creating another windbreak. He felt her shaking and realized she was laughing with delight, though he could barely hear it. The wind blew away the smell of her hair, too, but for a moment he imagined he could smell it again. It made him ache.
"Watch this!" he shouted.
In the distance, an island appeared. He leaned and the skimmer veered hard toward it. Indeed, he'd quickly learned that the skimmer was capable of maneuvering much faster than he could. The real limit was how quickly he could change direction without tearing himself in half. He leaned right and then left, carving beautiful turns on the calm seas. He angled the reeds down and the skimmer popped over one of the bigger waves, and suddenly they were airborne. For more than 100 paces, they flew, silent except for the sound of the wind, right over the little island. Then they landed like a skipping stone and were off once more. In the speed and wind and the closeness of Karis, Gavin finally felt free once more. Despite the warmth of the day, the wind was cold, and if Karis didn't quite burrow into him, she did let her body fully relax against his, grateful for his warmth. If she got too cold, he knew, she would draft Sub Red, but she was saving her strength. She didn't know what waited for her in Tyria. That he did, at least in part, lent sweetness to the moment. She would read the White's letter and learn that he'd fathered a child while they were betrothed. Though she now professed no interest in his love life, it had been one of the questions she'd asked when he broke it off. Is there another woman? No. Have there ever been any other women while we've been betrothed? No, I swear it. Karis wouldn't forgive him this time. It had taken years for her to forgive him for breaking their betrothal and refusing to answer why, but this was betrayal. Or Holum, how he'd miss her. He avoided the shipping lanes and stayed far from shore. Around noon he saw clouds ahead. It didn't look like a storm, so he guessed that it was the island satrapy of Ilita. It was a country of many ports and more pirates. The central government had collapsed decades ago, now parts of it were ruled by whatever pirate lord was powerful at the moment. Most of the 7 satrapies paid tribute to one or another of the pirate lords, enriching them and enabling them to do more piracy. Gavin had no fear of them, but he didn't want to be seen either. While it might be good for the pirates to have another reason to fear the Chromeria, he'd prefer to keep his little invention secret for as long as possible. Besides, he was only using Ilita as a landmark. It was a lot of trouble to use an astrolabe, and in the time it took him to calculate their position, he could just skim around until he found it. Garriston was at the mouth of a large river. It was the busiest port in Tyria, but that wasn't saying much. He turned south. Karis said something to him, but he couldn't hear her, so he slowed the skimmer.
"Can I try too?" she asked.
"I thought you were saving your strength."
"You can't have all the fun."
Because he was behind her, he couldn't see her whole smile, but he saw one dimple and one raised eyebrow. He widened the skimmer's hull so they could stand side by side and handed over the starboard reed. Karis always preferred to draft from her right hand. At first they were out of sync, and the craft shuddered and strained as they threw the plugs at different speeds and times. He looked over at her, but before he could say anything, she took his right hand in her left. She squeezed a tempo to keep him on the beat, as she used to do when they danced. The memory hit him as if the skimmer had clipped a reef and smashed him into the sea. Karis, 15 years old, before the war, at the yearly Lux Lord's Ball on top of the Chromeria. Her light blonde hair was long and straight and as fine and shiny as her green silk dress.
Their fathers were in discussion on which of the Guile brothers she would marry. Gavin, the elder brother, and likely to become the next prism, was of course the richer prize. His father, Andros Guile, didn't care about Caris's beauty.
"You want a beautiful woman? That's what mistresses are for."
But though he didn't care for the boy's preferences, alliances were to be bought as cheaply as possible, and the marriage of his firstborn was the most valuable stone he had to play. Andros Guile was well aware that other families weren't always so calculating. Some fathers were loath to marry their daughters to men they didn't care for. Andros Guile had ordered the younger Dazen to seduce Caris.
"There's a servant's room one floor down. Here's the key. 20 minutes after you leave with her, I'll make some pretext for her father and I to speak privately, and we'll come down. I expect to catch you in the act. I'll be surprised, dismayed, furious. I'll most likely strike you, but what is one to do? The passions of youth and so forth. You understand."
Both brothers did. Luxlord Rissom Whiteoak was reputed to be hot-tempered. Andros Guile would strike Dazen first and get himself between the two, so Whiteoak didn't try to kill Dazen. But the real point was that if Caris were caught making love with Dazen, her father would have no choice. So as not to shame the Whiteoaks, Caris would quickly be married to Dazen. The families would be allied, and Andros Guile would still have his more valuable elder son to play.
"Gavin, I expect you to be pleasant, but not encouraging with the girl. If your brother fails the family in this, you will have to marry her."
"Yes, sir."
But then the ball had begun. Gavin had taken the first dance with Caris, and the worst possible thing had happened. Holding her petite form against him, her hand in his, squeezing out the beat, and looking into her jade green eyes. At the time she had had only the tiniest flecks of red in her irises, Gavin had been enchanted. By the time Dazen came to dance with her, Gavin was in love. Or lust, anyway. "I've been betraying Caris since before we even met." Caris squeezed his hand harder than she had been. He looked over. Her eyes held a question. He must have tensed, and Caris had caught it. She'd always been deeply physical. She hugged or brushed or touched those she loved all the time. Dancing was as natural to her as walking. She didn't touch Gavin often anymore. He gave a dismissive smile and shook his head. "It's nothing." Caris opened her mouth to speak, paused.
"Make the tubes bigger," she shouted and laughed, the barest edge on it.
A forced laugh. So she remembered the dance, squeezing out the beat into his hand. Of course she did. But she was letting it go, and he was grateful for it. He widened the reeds as far as they could handle, and soon they were going faster than he'd ever gone by himself. He hadn't meant to show her this next trick, but he couldn't help himself. He knew it would bring her real joy. And what fun is it being a genius if no one appreciates you? He released Caris's hand. This part was the most dangerous. At this speed, running into something deliberately was stupid, and yet...
"Brace yourself,"
he shouted. Throwing his right fist forward, Gavin threw Green Luxin out as far in front of them as he could. It landed on the waves with a splash. A moment later, the skimmer hit the Green Luxin ramp. In an instant, they were airborne, flying 20 paces above the waves. Gavin released the whole reed apparatus and drafted. The Luxin of the platform shot up his and Caris's backs, and then shot out from his arms. They were falling now, 15 paces from the waves, and even if hitting them at this speed meant they would skip rather than just splash, they were still falling 20 paces. The Luxin spun out in every colour, trying to form despite the gale-force wind. 10 paces to the waves, 5. At this speed, hitting the water would be like hitting granite. Then the Luxin hardened in its shape, which was as much like a condor's wings as Gavin had been able to manage. The wings caught the air, and Caris and Gavin shot into the sky. The first time Gavin had attempted it, he'd tried to hold one wing in each hand. He'd learned then why birds have hollow bones and weigh almost nothing. The lift had nearly torn his arms off. He'd gone home wet, bruised, and angry, with most of the muscles in his arms and chest torn.
By making the condor all one piece instead, he'd taken away the need for muscle at all. The whole thing flew on the strength and flexibility of the Lux in speed and wind. Of course, it didn't really fly, it glided. He'd tried to use the reeds, but it hadn't worked so far. For the time being, the condor had a limited range. Caris wasn't complaining. She was wide-eyed.
"Gavin! Or Holum, Gavin, we're flying!" she laughed, carefree.
He'd always loved that about her. Her laughter was freedom for both of them. She'd forgotten about the dance. That made it worth it. "Get in the middle," he said. He didn't have to shout. They were completely inside the body of the condor. There was no wind. "I'm not very good at turning. Mostly I lean one way or the other." Indeed, because he was heavier, they were already turning toward his side. Together they leaned toward her side until the condor straightened.
"The White doesn't know about this, does she?" Caris asked.
"Only you," he said. "Besides,
no one else could do the drafting required," Caris finished for him.
"Galyb and Tarkian are probably the only polychromes who could handle all the colours necessary, and neither of them is fast enough. If I can make it easy enough for other drafters, I might tell her."
"Might?"
"I've been thinking about the ways this could be used. In war, mostly. The Seven Satrapies already fight and scheme over the few polychromes there are. This would make it 100 times worse."
"Is that garrison?"
she said abruptly, looking north and west.
"Already?"
"The real question is whether you want to crash onto land or into the water," Gavin said.
"Crash?"
"I'm not very good at landing yet, and with so much extra weight."
"Excuse me," Caris said.
"What? I haven't tried flying with a manatee aboard either. I'm just—"
"You did not just compare me to a sea cow?"
Her expression made ice look warm. "No, it's just all the extra weight."
"What is it you're supposed to do when you're in a hole?"
"Oh." He cleared his throat. She grinned, suddenly dimples flashing.
"After all this time, Gavin, I still get you," she laughed.
He laughed ruefully, but the pain went deep.
"And I still don't get you." Maybe she would have been happy with Dazen.